Today on Maine Calling, the next step towards restoring Maine's rivers. In the half century since the Federal Clean Water Act went into effect, Maine's rivers have made a remarkable recovery, but they are still not as healthy as they could be. Dam removals and culvert replacements all over Maine have improved water flow and fish passage. Now, ecologists are turning their attention to creating better river habitats. This involves looking at things like nutrient levels and water chemistry. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will learn about this next step in river restoration. Some of the projects sound counterintuitive, such as felling large trees into rivers or letting riverbanks become overgrown. How to foster clean water and healthy river systems, next on Maine Calling.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. By Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at WelchForbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, supporting Maine island communities through education, health, and community engagement. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. We've heard about efforts to restore Maine's rivers over the years, and dam removal has been a big part of that discussion. But today we're going to learn about some newer approaches to river restoration. Joining me for this hour, Eileen Bader-Hill, who is a freshwater restoration manager for the Nature Conservancy in Maine. Chris Federico is executive director and habitat restoration manager for Project Share. And Jacob Vandesande is project manager for Eastern Washington County with the Maine Coast Heritage Trust. We invite you to join the conversation. What do you want to know or share about the health of Maine's rivers? Are you part of a project? Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you all very much for joining us. Eileen, I'll start with you. Maine's image, of course, is a place of natural beauty. And I think a lot of people believe that Maine's rivers are now and finally clean and pristine. Is that not the case? It looks as though I might have lost Eileen, so I'll go to you, Chris. Go ahead. Answer the question for her. Are our rivers not clean?
They're clean. I wouldn't say they're pristine, though. They're quite a bit different from how they probably were historically before.
So what do you mean by that?
So the log drive era did a lot of damage to the rivers and streams of Maine, and we're hoping to get them working a little bit better than what they are currently.
And so what kind of damage? I mean, the log drives were a long time ago. How did they reshape Maine's rivers?
A big part of it was, you know, they needed to get the logs down the river as efficiently as possible each year. So they had to remove a lot of impediments that would have, you know, slowed down the drive or stalled the drive completely. So they would have removed all the big boulders, lots of log jams, things like that.
All right. Well, Jacob, I'll turn to you now. We've discussed river health many times on Maine Calling, and most recently, for the past few years, the focus has been on fish passage. And that is, removing dams to allow migratory fish to spawn and widening culverts to create more natural river flow. But that's not enough, right? What else is needed?
Yeah, I think when we have been focused on dams and impediments to fish passage, culverts for a long time, but on rivers where the fish have have good access, we still see the populations not doing as well, particularly brook trout and Atlantic salmon, which are sensitive to water quality and habitat. And so we started to ask questions about, you know, what's going on in these rivers. And one of the pieces that has come up is what Chris was referring to, is the rivers are overwide and shallow, and they lack diversity. They're kind of uniform. And so it creates a number of issues. It means that there's more, if they're wide and shallow, the sun beats down and it heats up that water. And we know, particularly with warming, that's a big issue for cold water fish. There's not places for the fish to hide from predators if it's too uniform. And the other thing that happens is you know, fish eat bugs, and the bugs are eaten, but the bugs eat leaf mat material and other things that fall into the river. And when the river is wide and uniform, all that food just washes downstream and it doesn't collect in the river. And so the bugs aren't there, they're eating it. And then the fish don't have as much food to eat. So we've really changed. You know, these fish had lived in these rivers for 10,000 years. They adapted to a situation in these rivers that was full of wood and all this diversity and flow and depth. And there was all this food. And that log driving era has radically changed the rivers. They look beautiful and we really think they're great, but they in fact are changed. The one other piece I would mention too is the other thing, historic impact, is acid rain. You know, our rivers are, we've cleaned up tremendously since the 70s, but acid rain persisted. They modified the Clean Air Act in 1993 because acid rain was still impacting the, particularly the Northeast. And so the other thing that's shifting is the temperature is going up and the pH of the river is still quite low and affecting fish's survival.
Jacob, I want to go back to what you were saying about Maine's rivers being so much wider and so much shallower than they used to be, and all the different ways that impacts the ecosystem. And I'm wondering, so what do we do? I'm thinking to myself, well, it can't be feasible to dredge rivers and to rebuild riverbanks. That just, I can't even imagine the engineering project that would be. How do we bring them back? And there's a phrase, large wood restoration, I just learned for the first time a few weeks ago. How does that work and how does that fix what you were talking about?
So certainly people have considered this, and there are projects all over the country where they engage in what we call fluviogeomorphology, which is the study of the shape and structure of rivers. And so there are people who are trained in this, and they in fact have re-engineered whole stretches of river with excavators and work. But when we look at the state of Maine, pretty much every river in the state of Maine was at some point in its history part of an industrial log delivery system. And they are radically different from how they were. So when we start to think about how we could change it back, excavators and all that doesn't make any sense. Just going to cost too much money. But what we also have learned through studying this is that much of the shape and structure of the river was controlled by large wood. So for thousands of years, the trees that grew up along the river died and fell into the river. As the river channel meanders, trees are recruited into the river. So 1,000 years ago, our rivers were full of jams and there was wood everywhere in these rivers. And so what we've started exploring, and this was pioneered in the Pacific Northwest, again, that ecosystem with those giant trees was really driven by the wood in the rivers. And they've been doing experiments out there and shown some really good results in pulling wood back into the rivers to mimic what went on 1,000 years ago. And so All right. Project Share has been pioneering work here in Maine of doing the same thing here.
All right. And I want to hear more about these projects in just a minute. Eileen, I want to turn to you. We have you back. Thank goodness. I want to ask you, you know, we're focusing and often when we talk about river restoration, a lot of the focus is on fish and creating a habitat for fish and the rivers not being, you know, whether it's passage or the rivers being the right temperature or the right chemistry. But you want us to think about it even bigger than that. This is, in your view, good for humans as well. Explain why.
Yes, absolutely. There are so many different ways in which stream and river restoration touch down in Maine. I think one of the big things I think about is it reminds me how our communities are all connected. So what happens upstream affects communities downstream and vice versa. And our waterways here in Maine are really beautiful and incredible, but need care and restoration for the same reasons our communities need care and restoration. You know, they're central to our well-being. And so when we can restore rivers to the point where they can maintain their own dynamic processes, which Jacob and Chris were talking about, then there are many benefits that can result from that. And so I'm thinking about how river restoration is at the nexus of key ecological and community and economic benefits. And so there's kind of this like win-win-win scenario a lot of times.
So what do you mean that when you say at the nexus of benefits? What do you mean by that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so thinking about, we've been talking about benefits to the river itself and how the river functions, and there's, you know, benefits to fish species and other aquatic organisms, but then we also think about with impacts of climate change, that there's more intense and frequent storm events that result sometimes in flooding that's exacerbated by dams or road stream crossings that are undersized or too small. And so obviously flooding has impacts on communities and property and infrastructure. And so just thinking about, you know, all of those pieces together.
All right. Chris, Jacob mentioned your project, Project Share. How long has it been around and what are you doing?
So this is our 30th year this year. We've just more recently, so we started kind of as an information exchange and then it evolved into actually us doing projects, which most of were connectivity projects, so removing and replacing undersized culverts and whatnot. More recently, we've started getting into more of the in-stream habitat work. So adding large wood back into the rivers, adding boulders back into the rivers. And we've been doing that pretty much full-time, more production since I came on board in 2017, I think it was. But yeah, so a majority of our projects now are big, large wood projects.
So even if the phrase large wood restoration is fairly new to most of us, this is something you've been doing for 7 years now.
Yeah, and it actually started before that. DMR and Project Share were doing small pilot projects in some of the tributaries down east back as early as 2007, 2008.
So tell us what they did and what they found. I mean, were they felling trees right on the riverbank and letting them fall into the water? Were they dragging boulders and trees from other places and situating them scientifically? And just tell me how it worked and then what you found in the time that in the streams and rivers where this has happened.
So the initial treatments were pretty small and they would have been, you know, just chainsawed, cut, felled trees into the streams. What they found was a lot of the, during high flow events, because they were just cut and not really secured into the stream, they would move and form big jams in individual spots. Later on, we started moving into what we call grip hoist trees, where we actually excavate part of the root mass, and we cut the roots and then pull the trees over, keeping part of the roots intact. We do a number of other we still do those quite often, but we're also starting to get into some more other treatment types which we refer to as we got mobile wood additions that we do, where we actually buy or get commercially harvested wood, put it off the side of a bridge into the streams, and let Mother Nature put the wood where she wants to. We also do big engineered log jam structures. We've started to do those, trying to work with the National Guard to actually use their helicopters to help us put wood in, but that's still in the works. But yeah, we do put a lot of trees into the river in the effort of.
Where you're putting trees in the river, I'm guessing it's creating eddies. It's creating the rivers carving out deeper places. Does that happen fast? Does the restoration do the benefits happen overnight, within months, within years? What are you seeing?
So depending on the treatment type, most of ours are real passive projects. So it takes a series of high flow events to actually start getting the stream bed mobilized again and starting to sort itself back out. These floods that we had last fall in December, November and December actually did a lot of work for some of our treatments down east. Some of the more invasive projects that we do, we can just do, we can put the bed where we want it, but we've only done a few of those. And but yeah, it's mostly a really passive, so it could happen that next fall spring event, high flow event, or it could take a couple few years before we get that high flow event. It's really the
Jacob,
water that
yeah.
does the work.
Has most of the focus here been down east?
Yes, that's been the area where there's been the most focus, and I think it in large part is related to Atlantic salmon because we know because as an endangered species, there's resources and interest, so there's been a real focus on that salmon habitat. And I think that's same thing in the Pacific Northwest. It's been salmon research that's really led to our understanding of the role of wood in these rivers. Certainly, brook trout also significantly benefit. I was going to comment related to what Chris was saying. I think that I mentioned that the rivers were sort of wide and shallow, and I think I can't overstress how embedded the river is. So the bottom of the river is a bunch of, rocks, so cobbles, gravels, all this stuff. And what we find is that it's immobile. The river is wide and shallow, so there's not enough energy to move the substrate. And so in a healthy functioning river, there's a constant movement of sediment downstream. And there's a sorting of sediment. So you have bigger sediment, smaller sediment, fine sediment is pushed off to the side. And that's really important for a variety of fish, for whether it's, feeding and cover and spawning. And it takes, Chris has put a lot of trees and rivers in places where it's still just so armored and without like a real flooding event, it doesn't change. But we are seeing with these big events and with larger treatments, we are starting to see that bed start to move. We want that substrate to be rolling around and moving and sorting itself to really benefit the fish.
Eileen, let's say I'm a private landowner. I'm listening to this conversation right now, and I'm thinking, well, streams and maybe even rivers go through my property. What can I do to improve them? Can I just fell some trees or move some boulders into my stream?
That's an excellent question. And actually, there is financial and technical assistance available for these sorts of projects through many different partners. But there's one mechanism in particular, I think, that I would highlight, which is the Regional Conservation Partnership Program, or RCPP, which is a program of the Natural Resources Conservation Service. And they have a project, an RCPP project, that's focused entirely on in-stream habitat and large wood additions. And so that is a collaboration of partners working directly with private landowners who might have an opportunity to do this sort of restoration on their property. And there's that technical and financial assistance available for that.
Well, we are talking about restoring Maine's rivers. Maybe the next chapter, past the dam removal, past the culvert widening. What now? How do we make Maine's rivers even better steward, even better ecologically balanced places, bringing back more fish, cutting down on flooding? What are your questions? The phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org or find us on social media. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We are learning now about different methods being used to bring Maine rivers back to life. Joining me for the hour, Jacob Vandesande with the Maine Coast Heritage Trust, Eileen Bader Hall with the Nature Conservancy in Maine, and Chris Federico with Project Share. Please join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to our Facebook or Instagram page. I'm going to go to, let's see here. I'd like to go to Tim, who's calling from Millinocket, but I'm having trouble clicking on that. If somebody else could click on Tim calling from Millinocket. Tim, are you there? Shoot. Okay, we'll wait just a second. And before that, I want to turn back to you, Jacob, and ask about, we've talked a lot about large wood, but is that the other only method? Are there other methods being worked on right now?
Well, in term, I mean, that's the big focus of sort of the fluvio-geomorphological perspective on these rivers. One of the other things that we talked about, I mentioned briefly, was the issues around pH and the acidity of the rivers. And so two things have happened over the past couple hundred years is one, when you do timber harvesting and logging, you do export a lot of nutrients from the system, runoff and rain. And then with the loss of diadromous fish, you know, the fish coming in from the ocean, spawning and leaving nutrients in the system has reduced, those things have really reduced the productivity. And then you add 100 years of acid rain to that, and we've lost a lot of nutrients, productivity from our systems. And we've also lost calcium and magnesium, which are basic building blocks of the bodies of all aquatic organisms. And what we found in particular is when the pH is very low, it also damages the gills of anadromous fish as they're headed out to the ocean. So Atlantic salmon survival is reduced when they go out into the ocean because of the impacts of low pH in the rivers. And so there's been a number of projects over the years to look at ways to bring the pH back up in the rivers to help with that, the gill health of the fish and with survival. So Project Share, DMR, Maine DEP have all worked together adding clamshells to the river. So clamshells are a great source of calcium, and they're a byproduct of the clam industry here. For example, here in Washington County, we have lots of clamshells, so you all can eat fried clams. And they've been adding them to the river and monitoring the impacts. And we've seen significant results increasing the number of macroinvertebrates, the bugs in the stream, and also the health and growth of salmon in the rivers.
I'm going to try to go to Tim again. Tim, who's calling from outside of Millinocket, are you there?
Yes, I am here.
Wonderful. Sorry about that. A technical glitch, I think. Go ahead.
I'm not exactly calling from Millinocket, but I'm calling about a camp that I own on the Pemetumcook Chain of Lakes, which is part of the west branch of the Penobscot River. And it's held up by the North Twin Dam. It's a fairly large set of lakes. And two things that kind of lead up to my question. One is I get my water from the lake with a 5-gallon bucket. And when I dip water in a white 5-gallon bucket from that lake, the water is not what I would call clear, and it never has been. It's, you know, slightly, I don't know what the color is, slightly yellowed, slightly brown, whatever. And the other thing is that about 20 years ago, they did some work on that dam one winter, and they completely opened it up, and they let the water go back to its natural level. And I was amazed at the number of 4-foot logs that were on the bottom of that lake. I mean, it literally covered with them. And it's been my understanding over the years that it's all that wood in the lake that causes oxygen depletion. And I'm wondering how introducing more wood to the water works with that. And maybe that isn't true, the oxygen depletion, but I guess my question is that the reason that the water is not particularly clear? And how would this effort to restore large wood to the water change that?
Who wants to tackle this one? Chris, go ahead.
I can kind of speak to it. I'm very familiar with that area. The brown color of the water is actually tannins in the water, similar to tea, or tannins is what makes red wine dry. But that's a lot of that has to do with the uplands. The hemlocks, the conifer forest, they produce a lot of tannins. So that's where a lot of the brown color comes into the water. You see similar things down east as well. But I'm not entirely sure about the wood on the bottom of the river causing, or bottom of the lakes, actually causing oxygen depletion. I'm not aware of any type of evidence that actually exists.
And Jacob, I see you shaking your head.
Yeah, I don't think that wood, you know, you notice that wood is still there. That means it's not really rotting. So there's not a lot of biological activity that's breaking that down that might demand oxygen. And so I don't think it's really a concern about biological oxygen demand in the river. I think that, and in a lake, it, you know, if that, it could be a situation, I suppose, in certain places, but we're talking mostly about rivers and flowing water. And certainly the wood is not going to deplete dissolved oxygen. In fact, this, you know, the mixing of the water that the wood creates probably increases oxygen levels. And that has been the natural condition for thousands of years. And that's what the fish have adapted to. So no real concerns there, I don't think.
Tim, thanks for calling in. I'm going to go to an email here from Robert. My house in Falmouth abuts a ravine where a small stream empties into Casco Bay. It's a wooded area, a variety of trees, oaks, maples, ash pines, and more. We don't tend it much, but I had been thinking I should be clearing out the old wood that has fallen into the water flow. Now I understand from this show that I should just let it be. What else should I be doing to improve my little piece of river? Should I be removing invasives like multiflora roses and burning bush, or just let it be? Eileen, I'll toss to you.
I mean, I think that's a great takeaway of, in terms of not cleaning out the river and letting the vegetation and the wood be part of the ecosystem that's creating the habitats for, you know, a great diversity of aquatic organisms. In terms of invasive species management, I think that's always a great endeavor, depending on how much time and effort you can put toward it. And then thinking about replanting of native species that can also help with, that would be appropriate for a riverbank situation.
All right, Jacob, what would you like to add to that?
I would just comment, I think the urge to remove wood is not uncommon. So I've been working in this field as a fisheries biologist for almost 30 years. And early in my career, working for the State Atlantic Salmon Commission, we were chainsawing wood out of streams in places. And so we've come a long ways in our scientific knowledge and understanding of how this all functions. So I don't think anyone should feel bad for maybe having removed wood in the past, but we are actively working to educate people to discourage them from bringing a chainsaw in their canoe and undoing the hard work that we're putting into these rivers.
Joining us now is Melissa Cody, who is Sheepscot River Watershed Manager for the Mid-Coast Conservancy. Thanks so much for calling in, Melissa.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call.
So tell us about your project. What's up there?
Sure. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about Mid-Coast Conservancy for a second. So we're a nonprofit conservation organization, and we work to protect and restore lands and waters in Mid-Coast Maine through a combination of water resource protection, restoration, land conservation. We currently have over 15,000 acres of land protected, and we're responsible for stewarding those 15,000 acres. And recently in the Sheepscot watershed, there have been three major fish passage projects, and we are celebrating one this Saturday, World Fish Migration Day at Branch Pond in China. All are welcome if you'd like to join. The information is on our website. But as the panelists mentioned earlier, the Sheepscot live also subject to the effects of the log drive era. So while aquatic connectivity is important, something we want to keep working on, the need to restore the in-stream habitat is also important for recovery of Atlantic salmon, which is the focus of a lot of our restoration work. And so, as I mentioned earlier, Mid-Coast Conservancy is a landowner. We own a few properties with river frontage on the Sheepscot. So there's a potential for us to implement these in-stream restoration projects like Project Share is doing down east, and to help restore the river's natural processes.
So how far along are you into these projects as far as the large wood projects and others like that? And what have you been seeing?
Yeah, so right now we're kind of in the planning phase. We're working on a project called a Rapid Stream Assessment with U.S. Fish and Wildlife in DMR that we are piloting the Sheepscot as a way to help us identify and prioritize areas in the river for in-stream restoration. In 2022, we surveyed about 12 reaches of the river. And the key takeaways are that there's a significant lack of wood in the river compared to what we'd expect. Like Jacob mentioned earlier, prior to the log drive era, the river is very straight and overwidened. This is all information that you just heard. But now we have the data to back it up and to start thinking about how we might restore these reaches and get them moving again and restore those natural processes. So we're right now kind of in the planning phase and prioritizing phase.
All right. Well, Melissa, good luck to you. Melissa Cody with the Mid-Coast Conservancy. We're going to go up to Orono. John Banks calling in. Hi, John. How are you?
Hi, Jennifer. How are you? Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for doing this program. Can you hear me okay?
I can. There's a bit of a buzzing in the background. It sounds like, are you on a work site or something like that?
No, I'm in my truck, and I don't dare to turn it off because I think I'll lose the call.
Well, tell it, you know, for those who don't know, John Banks, you know, has done so much important work, especially for the Penobscot Nation in river restoration work. As you listen to the show today, what are your thoughts?
Well, the reason I called is I was really excited to hear the gal talk about the nexus between the human ecology and the natural ecology. And of course, the tribes have been operating at that nexus for thousands of years. So I just wanted to do a shout out for that part of the presentation. And I also just wanted to mention, I was down in Thomaston last night doing a talk with the Thomaston Historical Society about the Penobscot River Restoration Project. And I was really excited about the folks down there in some of these fishing communities that have lost their, you know, their deep sea and near shore fishing industries. They're really knowledgeable about the connections between the rivers and the ocean. And so, you know, it's programs like this, what you're doing now, Jennifer. And I want to thank all the people that are on this program today and everyone that's calling in, because it's this kind of education and science that is really starting to, I think, take hold with people in their understanding of how important river restoration is to the whole area. So thank you for doing the program, and thank you for taking my call.
Well, you're welcome. And before we let you go, because it's such a treat to have you call in, I want to ask, in the decades that you've done this work, and I think you might have answered this question a little bit, but how have you seen attitudes change? I'm guessing early on, people kind of scratched their head and thought you were sort of being exaggerating a little bit. But I don't want to put words in your mouth. How have you seen a change in attitudes toward river restoration?
Well, I think sometimes change is hard to accept and hard to understand. And I'll use something that happened when we were getting ready to remove the Beasy Dam. There was one landowner there that was dead set against the project. And he had his dock and he had his boat on the impoundment, and he'd come home from work every day and jump in his boat and go catch some smallmouth bass, and he loved it. And so what happened was, you know, he was very much opposed to the project. He even closed off his property so the people working on it couldn't cross his land. But after the project and a few years when we started seeing some of the fish returns, he did a 180. He even wrote an op-ed, I believe, in the BDN, talking about, you know, how short-sighted he was earlier, and that he didn't, you know, he didn't really understand what the benefits would be. So now he can go, now he can catch stripers and shad and other sea lionfish. So that's just an example that I use, like to tell folks about, you know, accepting change.
Well, John, thank you so much for calling in. That's John Banks, the longtime natural resources director for the Penobscot Nation. And when I say long time, 40 years, right?
Yeah, something like that.
Well, thank you very much for calling in, John. We're going to go to another question here. Let's see. This is from Mary. Mary asks on an email, are companies now discharging pollutants into Maine rivers? If so, how can they be stopped? So which of you has the most information on what is still being or is not being discharged into Maine rivers? I don't think I have the right panel for that. We maybe need the DEP for that to answer Mary's question. But I will say the next email is related. This is from Rob. Rob says, I wanted to mention that the Maine DEP has a new program in its first year of operation designed to prevent pharmaceuticals from entering our native waters, including lakes, streams, rivers, and coastal aquatic systems. We know that the presence of some of these pharmaceuticals can impact the health of aquatic ecosystems. So, Jacob, is this something that you've encountered as you do the testing for, I know you're testing for things like pH of the water. Are we also looking for the presence of pharmaceuticals?
I'd say a couple things. First of all, I mean, the previous question, yes, there are still extensive discharges into our waters in the state of Maine. DEP has a whole water quality classification system to sort of address that. And so certainly in the larger rivers and in the, you know, more populated areas, it's still a significant concern. And there's always, DEP is always working with with industry to reduce impacts and municipalities. There's been a lot of infrastructure money lately to help municipalities clean up their sewage treatment plants. I mean, fortunately for me, I work primarily in Washington County, and we do not have much of that. I certainly am not concerned about pharmaceutical discharges, you know, from sewage treatment into our waters in Washington County. I would think in the larger rivers in the state lower down, that certainly could be a concern. But fortunately, I live in a part of the state with less people, and really the water quality is pretty good.
All right. Well, a note about this topic of river restoration. Tomorrow evening on Maine Public Television, you can see the local film, A Watershed Moment, about the restoration of the Bagaduce River watershed. That film airs at 9 p.m., and you might see Jacob in it. We are going to take another quick break. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We are learning about river restoration in the next chapter, which includes something called large wood, bringing large wood into rivers. Joining me, Jacob Vandesande with the Maine Coast Heritage Trust, Eileen Bader Hall with the Nature Conservancy in Maine, and Chris Federico with Project Share. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. We're going to go to Westbrook and Mike. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I'm a member of Trout Unlimited, and I just want to do a shout-out. The Mill River Preserve is seeing a big alwive return right now. In 2002, they removed the Smeltill Dam, which was at the head of the tidewater, and it opened up 7 miles of river. And right now, the alwives are going up in the Highland Lake. So if folks get a chance, it's a great walk, and you can see them by the hundreds. And it's a success story. And things like culvert restoration, moving fish and things that kept the fish from moving is great. And the consequence of that is you'll see more seals at the mouth of the river because they feed on the alwives as they come in and out. The seals are back in big numbers, and the apex predators are starting to show up. You go to Green Island Ledge in Casco Bay, you'll see 400, 500, 600 seals out there at some points in time. So here come the great white sharks. And it's all a success story. And that's in large part to the 72 Clean Water Act that cleaned up the river, allowed the fish to get back into the areas that were normally polluted, and cleaning up, you know, Back Cove was an open sewer for a long time because that's where everybody's streets flowed into. And it's all very good success.
So sure. Mike, thanks for calling in. And I think that I think all of our panelists would agree with you. And they're saying, yes, it's all been wonderful. And thank you for giving us the tips on where we can see the alewives right now. I think you all are saying, yes, it's all wonderful, but we can do even better. Am I right, Jacob?
Yeah, definitely. I think that there's still a lot of connectivity issues that need to be addressed. And then in the places with connectivity, we can start to really look at the in-stream habitat and really improving that so the numbers can keep increasing, the recreational opportunities, the fishing opportunities all increase over time. And it feeds the economy of the region, whether it's for tourism or it's alewife harvest, you know, bait for lobsters. These are all part of this process that it just keeps growing. And I think it was mentioned earlier, Eileen, you know, sort of mentioning this sort of larger picture. The other piece is, and our question just was mentioning the ocean. Ultimately, we believe that if we can restore river herring, salmon, alewives, all of our native diadromous fish, that this will also help increase groundfish populations. Historically, groundfish were an important part of the economy and the culture of Maine, but they've really declined by the 90s. There's very few fishing permits left in the state of Maine, but we hope that if we can restore all these diadromous fish and improve the quality of the habitat in the freshwater, that then feeds into the ocean and we see that ecosystem improve and we see, you know, groundfish recover so that we could then be eating groundfish that are caught locally and the whole ecosystem's, you know, it sees the advantages of this work.
Mike is calling from Westbrook, Eileen, and I know because I've spent some time with naturalists there that one of the issues with the river in Westbrook, and I'm sure in other places too, is that over the centuries, people have cleared the riverbanks and made these beautiful grassy slopes down to the river, but that's not really great for the long-term health of a river, right? What do you encourage towns and communities to do with their riverbanks?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's such an important point and gets at, I've been thinking about in this conversation, the watershed scale restoration, I think that we're talking about, and it takes all parts, right? Work in the headwaters, work on the larger tributaries, work on the main stem to make that connection all the way to the ocean. And then it's also all along those lengths of streams and rivers. And so having riverbanks that are as natural as possible so that they're part, you know, they're, we would expect rivers and streams to have periodic flooding, that would be a natural part of the system. And you know, for that part of the system to function as best as possible, you know, trees and shrubs and native plants along the river banks would be ideal, you know, as far as possible in.
Yeah, Mike, thanks for your call. We're going to go to Deborah calling from Cushing. Hi, Deborah, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm on the board of the Georges Riverland Trust in Midcoast, Maine, and we have beaver activity on several points along the river. Just wanted to ask your panelists if that is something they would see as a beneficial situation happening along our riverbanks. My guess is yes, because they're sort of disturbing the tree life along the river, but I would love to know more about what they think about beaver activity and the health of rivers in general.
And Deborah, just so you know, you're not the only person asking about beavers. We have emails about that as well. And we actually did a whole program, Maine Calling program on beavers a few weeks ago. So you can look that up. But Chris, I'll toss this one to you. How do you feel when you're out in the field and you see a beaver dam? Does that make your heart sing or do you think, oh no?
Depends on where it is. If it's on one of the culverts, then it's a bit of an issue. The issue is the human beaver interaction. So as long as they're building beavers up in the headwaters away from road crossings and not flooding out roads and stuff, they should be there. There's kind of evidence to say that there should be a lot more of them. They would have done as much, if not more work than putting trees in the river. With enough beavers actually doing the work for us, that would help my summer crew out quite a bit from having to keep hauling in trees. But give and take.
Deborah, thanks for your call. Eliza with Maine Conservation Policy writes, the Appalachian Mountain Club is engaged in watershed scale habit restoration in Piscataquis County in the west and middle branches of the Pleasant River, a tributary of Penobscot. Working with many partners, we have opened 132 miles of stream to fish passage, undertaken large wood additions known as chop and drop to restore the natural condition of riverbeds once cleared for the log drives, and planted Atlantic salmon eggs. As a result, this endangered species is returning to its historic headwaters at Gulf Haggis after about 180 years. None of this would have been possible without the Penobscot River Restoration Project. All three of the guests nodding there, so I'm guessing that this, Jacob, is one of the big, big exciting victories of your community.
I just wanted to come after saying earlier that most of the large woodwork was going on in Washington County, I wanted to sort of back that up and say, I do know that the Appalachian Mountain Club has been doing a bunch of large woodwork. I know Rangeley Lake Heritage Trust is also engaged in that work. And so I have met with a bunch of those partners in different projects. And I think I would encourage that along. It's exciting that it's starting to happen across the state because it's certainly an issue across the state. We're lacking wood across the state. So there are other folks engaging in this important work.
All right, we're going to go to Kitsy calling from Portland. Hi, Kitsy, go ahead.
Hi, Jen. What an incredibly wonderful program. And I didn't realize until somebody right from there called me back and said that John Banks, I guess, is an Indigenous. I would have started with talking about the Indigenous people of Maine. And it seems that the wonderful things are happening, and I'm so encouraged from this entire phone session, this hour. But I just think more homage to the Indigenous people of Maine, and I'm assuming lots of people consult with them, but I would like to see them featured more prominently. That's all. They were here first, and they knew how to live in right relationship with every aspect of nature, and certainly the Penobscots for the river, but all
Kitsy,
of them.
Thanks so much for your call. And Chris, I'll turn to you. You're working in eastern Maine. Are you working with the Passamaquoddy tribe there?
Limited scope. They are more focused on the St. Croix, which they should be. Both townships are both located right directly on the banks of the St. Croix. Most of our work is farther west. So we work with them some on some road crossings and stuff like that. But so far, the large woodwork we've kind of kept to ourselves.
All right, so different groups doing different parts, different regions. Jacob?
Yeah, I was just going to say that, as we talked about before, you start out with the fish passage issues, and so the areas of focus for the Passamaquoddy tribe are areas that still have significant fish passage issues, and I hope those will all be addressed, and then we can move on to in-stream habitat restoration collaboration.
All right, Kitsy, thanks so much for your call. An email here from Bill. How will putting trees in the river affect canoeing down those rivers? Eileen, is this an issue being raised?
Well, I think this might be an opportunity, Jacob, if you might want to mention a video that you've worked on that talks about this very concern.
Sure, yeah. So I'm an avid paddler. And I recognize the issues that trees, you know, sweepers are a known hazard in whitewater paddling. And we are, in fact, putting sweepers into the river in some places. I'll say a couple of things. One, we are not, so we're working on some rivers down east, and we are not doing this work in areas that are traditionally popular whitewater paddling locations. We are working further up in the watersheds. We're trying to educate people on the topic. So the biologists who do the fish population monitoring have to canoe down through these same stretches of river. A lot of the stretches, it's narrower, but you can still paddle through it, but you definitely have to get out and drag your canoe in places. But we are very aware and are trying not to do this work and do it in ways that would be in any way threatening to, you know, to people's health and well-being in paddling. We encourage, you know, it's a big part of my job is encouraging people to recreate in the outdoors. And so we're very sensitive to this and want to educate people and get people engaged in the conversations. And so Eileen mentioned a video that we've been working on in partnership. I think we have 9 partners, including Project Share and the Nature Conservancy in Maine. And this whole thing, the whole history of log drive of our rivers, you know, going back thousands of years up to the present and the role of large wood. People were, you know, it's sort of an abstract concept to people. So we wanted to create something that could really help people better understand. So we actually engaged the services of Puckerbrush Animation, folks who do temp tales. And we've created a 3.5-minute video that sort of captures this whole story. And there's a little humor and a little fun in it, and it shows it graphically in a way you can really understand how the rivers were, what's happened to those rivers, and how we're working to restore them. So this video is going to be released for World Fish Migration Day, which Melissa mentioned earlier. So coming up this Saturday, it's World Fish Migration Day, and we're going to release the video, and all of our partners are hopefully posted on social media. But on Saturday, you can watch your social media feed from sort of river restoration folks in the state, or you could go to Restoring Rivers on Maine Coast Heritage Trust website. So it's mcht.org, and I would encourage you to watch it and share it and get excited about it. We want to spread the word. We want to get people excited about this and see it really happening at a larger scale.
All right. An email here from Jeff. Here in Western Maine, the Androscoggin River Watershed Council has removed log driving dams high up in the Sunday River to restore stream connectivity. We've also used rock veins and root wads to add diversity to streams and project infrastructure. So another project. This kind of work is going on all over the place. I appreciate all of you for joining us today for Maine Calling to talk about river restoration. Eileen Bader Hall, Freshwater Restoration Manager for the Nature Conservancy in Maine. Chris Federico, Executive Director and Habitat Restoration Manager for Project Share. And Jacob Van De Sande is Project Manager for Eastern Washington County with the Maine Coast Heritage Trust. Today's sound engineer was Jane Donahue. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. You can find our past shows and sign up for Maine Calling's weekly newsletter by going to mainecalling.org. And you can share your thoughts with Maine Calling by using the Maine Public VoxPop app. Download it and easily record your comments. Tomorrow on the program, how the work of the Passamaquoddy artist, Jeremy Frey, is calling attention to the art of Wabanaki basket making. He has a brand new show opening Friday at the Portland Museum of Art. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.